observe. What do you learn? What is going on? What's gone on before the verse or the chapter that you're studying? What comes after? And really kind of observe a load of stuff. And then A equals application. Okay? How does what I'm reading apply to me? I believe that there's loads of application that we can utilize in the Bible. The Bible is relevant for us today. Okay? The Bible is our guidebook for life. It's our toolkit for life. And so how does, even though we're studying something in the Old Testament, we're studying Joshua, how is it relevant to me? Okay? Apply it to our lives. And that's what we're trying to do in these studies all the time, is to not only just give a nice Bible study, but I'm really keen that we apply it to our lives, that we apply the truths, the principles to our lives. And then, of course, P stands for prayer, all right? And just pray about what you've learned. Just stop, read, think, pray over it. And it's in those times of prayer that God will reveal something to you and open up the scriptures anew once again, give you revelation. So it's a real simple method that I use. I ask a lot of questions, and I also use this soap method quite a bit in my Bible studies. Just some simple tools to help us. Is that okay with everybody? I just thought I'd just throw that in right at the start. For those of us who are maybe new to the faith, or we're just new to studying the scriptures, there's some good tools there for us. Okay, last week, everybody, we were studying Rahab. Okay, we were looking at Rahab in Joshua 2, and it raised lots of conversations and lots of discussion. And I asked five questions last week, and if you've got an answer, that would be great. If you could just wave at me or Gary, and we'll put you on and you can give an answer. But let me just run through these five questions, and then Gary, if you take the screen share off, that would be good. So number one, do you think that Rahab acts in true faith in God or out of fear for her life? Number two, Rahab moved from knowledge of God to trust in God. How did she express this? Number three, how do you move from knowledge of God to trust in God? And how did you express this? Number four, God is faithful. What ways has God specifically shown himself to be faithful to you? What were the circumstances? And number five, how does the story of Rahab encourage you in your relationship with Jesus Christ? Thank you, Gary. So I'm just wondering if anybody wants to give an answer to any of these questions. Let's take number one, for example. Do you think that Rahab acts in true faith in God or out of fear for her life? What were your thoughts on question number one? Has anybody got an answer there? Oh, we've got an answer. We'll go to Johnny first, and then we'll go to Janet, Gary. So Johnny, D. Hello, Johnny. We can hear you now. Go for it.
Rahab appears to have acted in fear of God. She said, "We are all afraid. Everyone feels hopeless. We hear how God dried up the waters of the Red Sea and what he did to the two kings, whom he put under a holy curse and destroyed them both." So in my opinion, I reckon that she was in fear of God at the beginning.
So she was in fear of God, the awesomeness of God. She heard about that. But do you think, does anyone else got an answer for that one, actually? That was great. Thank you so much, John. Go for it, Gabe.
So what I wrote for this is that God has like a reputation already among the neighboring cities and regions. So I think that there is fear. And then a light bulb moment of why should I fear when I can join the side of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Oh my gosh, you know, these people are from this amazing God who can do all these great things. I should be scared. Wait, hold on. Why don't I join in and have no reason to be scared? I think there was a mix of both for sure. That she went from fear to faith, which is a journey that a lot of people go through as well.
Hey, Gabe, that's absolutely brilliant. A journey of fear to faith. We all go through that, don't we? I think there was genuine fear from the Canaanites, from those pagan kings and nations, when they heard about the awesomeness of God and what God had done. And there's fear. People are feared for their lives. But Rahab maybe initially started off in fear, but her process was one, you're right, Gabe, of fear to faith. And what do I have to fear if I put my trust in the living God? Surely he's a God of mercy and justice and grace as well. And so I think there's a bit of both there, in my opinion. Caroline, go to Caroline, please. Go for it, Caroline. Oh, no, we can't hear you. There we are. Go for it, Caroline.
I don't always think that faith and fear are definitely necessarily mutually exclusive, but actually you can actually be afraid and still have faith.
Yes.
That sometimes you have to step out, even if you are afraid. It's not necessarily a case of waiting until you're not afraid to act out in faith. Mm-hmm. So I don't necessarily know they're mutually exclusive.
Ah, great comment. Thank you. Okay, listen. Let's move on. Number two, Rahab moved from knowledge of God to trust in God. How did she express this? Has anybody got an answer there? How did Rahab move from knowledge of God to trust in God? Any comments? Ooh, let's have a little look around, or I'll check out the...
You've got the answer, do you?
Oh, anyone got an answer for that one?
Cat.
Sorry, Cat. Go for it, Cat.
That's all right. Yeah, I thought this question was quite interesting because at first I thought it was when she put the,
record
out of the window. But then I was thinking, well, actually, when she didn't have to hide the spies and... So I think that at the moment she hid the spies, there must have been part of her that thought, if I do this favour for God's people, then God will do something in return for me and protect me.
Mm. Yeah, wonderful. Great. No, absolutely. It was some sort of, this is the process that we're talking about. People can have knowledge of God. I've got neighbors, I've got friends who have a knowledge of God, but there's something that happens, isn't there, that goes from knowledge, that goes from head, that goes to the heart. And Rahab went through this process of knowledge of God to kind of a trust in God. Maybe it was from the testimony of those spies. She was talking to them and something clicked. I think something was sown in her heart even before the spies, maybe. And so, so she certainly went from this knowledge of God to a trust in God. Okay, just a personal kind of question, really, and you don't have to answer, but how did you move from knowledge of God to trust in God? What was your story? What was your process of coming to God? And maybe, actually, Johnny, can I pick on you here?
Yeah. I moved from the knowledge of God to trust in God with the help of Riviera Life Church.
Go on, tell us your story.
And the family. When the first year I went with Dee, me and Dee arranged to go out on the Saturday to meet up and go out for a coffee, but I was unwell. And then she said, what about Sunday? And I said, yeah, she says, I should be okay for Sunday. And she said, I'm going to church. Would you like to come to church with us? So I said, yeah, I'll come to church with you. And then, obviously, I went to Riviera Life Church. And when I went in, I just felt the whole place, the whole everybody, nobody judged anybody. Everybody was very welcoming. And I went in, and I think it was Ian was giving me a sermon. And then he asked the question, is anybody here who was not sure about anything? And I put my hand up, and I'll never forget it. There was a guy at the front, and he climbed over all the benches to get to us, to put his hand on us. And I'm thinking, this guy doesn't even know me. He doesn't know my life. Doesn't know if I'm bad, if I'm good. He just wasn't bothered. And my heart just went out. And that's how I've got it with Riviera Church and the family. Yeah.
Wonderful. What a great testimony, everybody. What a great story. Thank you so much, Johnny. You just went from maybe knowing about this God, hearing about him, to kind of experiencing him and experiencing all his goodness for yourself. We're going to push on. Number four, we know that God is faithful. What ways has God specifically shown himself to be faithful to you? Okay. What were the circumstances? Has anyone got a brief story on the faithfulness of God in their lives to them at all that they want to share in answer to that question? You can wave at me. Oh, Sheila. Let's go to Sheila. Sheila's iPad, please, Gary.
Yeah, it's not unmuted from my side. Sheila, see if you can unmute yourself.
Yeah. Just that God brought me out of a serious illness. And I just felt God's faithfulness in my life. And also, and then recently Claire was ill, and God brought her out of that. So yeah. I just feel it just gives you trust in God.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He's a faithful God, and we're going through some stuff right now, but guess what? We're in it, and we're going to come out the other side because he's faithful. All right, and that's a wonderful, wonderful story. Finally, everybody, how does the story of Rahab encourage you in your Christian walk or in your relationship with Jesus Christ? How are you encouraged from the story of Rahab? Has anybody got any comments on that one before we move on? Oh, Dee, let's go to Dee's.
Yeah, Dee, you'll have to unmute yourself again.
Yeah.
Okay. It's just the fact, it's the reassurance of knowing that no matter who you are, what your past history is like, the things you might have done, it's like I put down in my notes that no matter what your background, your upbringing, the fact that I'm a sinner, the bad things I've done in my life, that I was a non-believer, then I became a believer, but I walked away from God for many years. But he never actually left me. He always kept his hand on me and me and my family. And then I came back sort of thing. So it's that knowing that you don't have to be perfect, because you can't be perfect, because God is the only perfect one.
Yes.
It's just that reassurance, that knowing.
Yes.
Of, you know, we all make mistakes, we all do things wrong. It's just the reassurance, just knowing his love's unconditional and it's always there. And he's, even when we're not constant to him, he's always constant to us regardless of the situation.
Mm. Mm. That's absolutely wonderful, Dee. I'm loving hearing these stories. This is the application that I'm talking about right at the beginning, everybody. It's how it's applying to our lives. Ian's written in the chat down here, if God can use a Rahab, he can use me. And actually, Ian spelt it rehab once again. Do you remember Maria from last week who got the name wrong? And she said, is it rehab? Rehab. But actually, that's what God does. He takes us on a journey of spiritual rehab from a point A to a point B. And Rahab went through rehab and she came out the other side. God is faithful. He loves us. I love the whole thing. It wasn't just her. It was her family. It was her household that was saved as well. God is in the business of saving households, and he's in the business of saving families as well. I believe that. I always will, and I'll hold on to that as well. Okay. So, wonderful. We're welcoming a few other people on by the looks of it, which is great. We've got Karen and we've got Peter as well joining us. Welcome, everybody. Welcome, Karen. Good to see you.
Hi.
So, what we're going to do, everybody, we're going to press on with session three right now. Session three. I've called this the crossing and the memorial, okay, because actually what we'd like to do is cover elements of Joshua chapter 3 and Joshua chapter 4 tonight. if we can, so we can really push on. We're heading to Jericho, everybody. We're almost at Jericho, but there's a few things to go before we do that. So I'm going to start off with this phrase. It's time to cross over. It's time to cross over, everybody. What do you think the phrase crossing over means? We actually hear this phrase quite a bit in terms of kind of society or even in church life or whatever. We're crossing over. We're crossing over. What do you think crossing over means? Has anybody got any thoughts? What is it to do with? It's time to cross over. Any thoughts? And you can wave at us again. Oh, Catherine, please, Gary. Go for it, Catherine, if you can hear us. Oh, no. You might have to unmute.
Catherine, you'll have to unmute yourself. Well, let me do it from this end.
No, we can't.
You need to press the unmute if you can. Technical fun and games. Hang on, just unmute everybody. 1 second.
Hello, Catherine. Can you hear me?
That's it.
Yeah.
There we are. Wonderful. We're there. Catherine, tell us some.
Well, for me, it's actually something, a great thing is crossing over. It's not just walking across the street. It's leaving the past behind.
Yes.
Very good.
Yeah,
it's
that's
new
great.
Roads. You are taking a new path. You have crossed, whether it's the Jordan or, crossed into your faith. It's a moving thing. You've gone from the past to your future.
Wonderful. I love that. There's something prophetic about this. You've gone from the past to your future. Caroline, did you just wave your hand a moment ago?
No, I was just putting something on the chat.
All right, okay. So yeah, I've put down here pushing boundaries, new area, new territory, new responsibilities, new mandates, new adventure. Maybe we cross over into new maturity as well. The Israelites, the children of Israel, they've been used to slavery in Egypt. They had experienced 40 years of wilderness, and they were about to claim the promises of God and walk into a life of freedom, life, land, abundance, fruitfulness, and they were about to walk into all that God had promised them. And I tell you what, whatever we're going through right now, I really believe, I was so excited by the prayer meeting last night. I'm so excited by what God is doing in the Bay, in our church, and how God is using us. The church is not shut. And I believe with all my heart that we're about to cross into something new. We're already walking in it, but I believe we're going to cross into something new, something different, something fresh, something exciting. We're praying that God will pour out his spirit on the Bay, on South Devon, on the nation. God is the God of the new thing. He's a fruitful God. And it's time for us to walk into all of that. Okay, and so that's kind of where we're going there. Does that make a bit of sense, everybody?
Yes.
Yeah. Wonderful. Did you know this? Everybody has a Jordan River. Everybody has a boundary line. I'm reading a great book at the moment by a pastor called John Cameron, and this is called Tales of a Conquering Generation. Okay, Tales of a Conquering Generation. And he says this, I'm going to read it slowly and carefully here. He says, imagine the Israelites coming to the edge of the river time and time again, wondering what is beyond, but never venturing across, knowing that it signified the edge of their territory, the boundary to what they could possess. After 40 years, the size of the river grew in their hearts and became more to them than a body of water to be forded. It became a line of containment. It represented a limit to their potential, a lid on their hopes and their dreams. Okay, so they were told that they could go into the promised land, the Israelites. They knew where it was, but between them and the promised land was the River Jordan. Okay? And the River Jordan represented a boundary line. Now, my sons, Harry and Jack, when they're allowed to play on the street, go on their bikes, they are only allowed to go to the second lamppost down the road. Okay? Now, my Harry, he sticks to the rules. Harry sticks to the rules. He doesn't go beyond. But Jack, however, he wants to go beyond. And Jack has just realized this last week that there's more beyond the boundary line. That was a bit of a pain because I had to go and look for him. But there's more beyond. There's more beyond. John Cameron says this as well. I believe every person has a Jordan River, a place they have been to, but never beyond. The Israelites would dream about the promised land of abundance, but were so accustomed to life in the wilderness that they struggled to comprehend what life would be like on the other side. They struggled to find the faith to make the shift into it. We too come to points in our lives that require a monumental shift in identity and perspective to overcome. Our Jordan River is a line that separates us from where we are and where God has planned for us to be. It's time to cross over. So once again, everybody, I want to say these words. There is more. Okay? There is more. There's more. There's a crossing over that's going to happen. So what we're going to do right now, everybody, we're going to read Joshua chapter 3. Joshua chapter 3. I hope all this is making sense so far. And yeah. So, Gary, have you got it on the screen or shall I read it from the Bible here?
Oh.
I'll read it. Oh, here we go. Here we go. Okay, here we go. Joshua 3, the Israelites crossed the Jordan. Early the next morning, Joshua and all the Israelites left Acacia Grove and arrived at the banks of the Jordan River where they camped before crossing. 3 days later, the Israelite officers went through the camp, giving these instructions to the people. When you see the Levitical priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, move out from your positions and follow them. Since you have never traveled this way before, they will guide you. Stay about half a mile behind them, keeping a clear distance between you and the Ark. Make sure you don't come any closer. Then Joshua told the people, purify yourselves, so tomorrow the Lord will do great wonders among you. In the morning, Joshua said to the priests, lift up the Ark of the Covenant and lead the people across the river. And so they started out and went ahead of the people. The Lord told Joshua, today I will begin to make you a great leader in the eyes of the Israelites. They will know that I am with you just as I was with Moses. Give the command to the priests who carry the Ark of the Covenant. When you reach the banks of the Jordan River, take a few steps into the river and stop there. So Joshua told the Israelites, come and listen to what the Lord your God says. Today you will know that the living God is among you. He will surely drive out the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Marmites, and the Jebusites ahead of you. Look, the Ark of the Covenant, which belongs to the Lord of the whole earth, will lead you across the Jordan River. Now choose 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one from each tribe. The priests will carry the Ark of the Lord of all the earth. As soon as their feet touch the water, the flow of water will be cut off upstream and the river will stand up like a wall. So the people left their camp to cross the Jordan and the priests who were carrying the Ark of the Covenant went ahead of them. It was the harvest season and the Jordan was overflowing its banks. But as soon as the feet of the priests who were carrying the ark touched the water at the river's edge, the water above that point began packing up a great distance away at a town called Adam, which is near Zarethan. And the water below the point flowed onto the Dead Sea until the riverbed was dry. Then all the people crossed over near to the town of Jericho. Meanwhile, the priests who were carrying the ark of the Lord's covenant stood on dry ground in the middle of the riverbed. As the people passed by, they waited there until the whole nation of Israel had crossed the Jordan on dry ground. Okay, thank you, Gary. Wonderful. I love that, what we've just read there. Some real, real powerful stuff. Okay, and you know, I've just lost my way a second. Yeah, so some real powerful stuff there when it comes to the whole River of Jordan just kind of splitting up there. And number one, I want to ask us, what is our perception of God? What is our view of God? How do we see God? How do we see him in action? What is our perception of God's work? You see, this account talks about the Ark of the Covenant probably about 9, 10, 11 times. We hear the Ark of the Covenant mentioned. Before we just talk any further, what do you know about the Ark of the Covenant? We're going to watch a little video right now just to help us understand the Ark of the Covenant. Okay, thank you, Gary. Hope this works.
Its length, a cubit and a half its width, and a cubit and a half its height. And you shall overlay it with pure gold. Inside and out you shall overlay it, and shall make on it a moulding of gold all around. You shall cast four rings of gold for it, and put them in its four corners. Two rings shall be on one side, and two rings on the other side. And you shall make poles of acacia wood, and overlay them with gold. You shall put the poles into the rings on the sides of the ark, that the ark may be carried by them. The poles shall be in the rings of the ark, they shall not be taken from it. And you shall put into the ark the testimony which I will give you. You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold. 2.5 cubits shall be its length, and 1.5 cubits its width. And you shall make 2 cherubim of gold, of hammered work. You shall make them at the 2 ends of the mercy seat. Make 1 cherub at one end, and the other cherub at the other end, and you shall make the cherubim at the 2 ends of it 1 piece with the mercy seat. And the cherubim shall stretch out their wings above, covering the mercy seat with their wings, and they shall face one another. The faces of the cherubim shall be toward the mercy seat. You shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony that I will give you. And there I will meet with you, and I will speak with you from above the mercy seat, from between the 2 cherubim which are on the ark of the testimony, about everything which I will give you in commandment to the children of Israel.
Wonderful. Thank you, Gary. So there's just a little graphic there about the Ark of the Covenant. You can do your own study about that. That's its own growth track study. But the Ark of the Covenant, it first appears in Joshua 3, verse 3. It's mentioned 17 times in Joshua 3 and Joshua chapter 4. The writer, the author of Joshua, does not want us, the readers, to lose sight of the Ark of the Covenant. The writers do not want us to lose sight of God. The Ark represents God's presence among his people. It meets us at every turn, reminding us that it is God who leads his people into Canaan. It's God who cuts off the flooding waters and holds them back. It's God. It's the hand of God. Joshua 4:24 kind of talks about the hand of God. This is God's work, okay? It's not about the people of Israel. It's not even about Joshua. It's about God. The Israelites are spectators. They are watching God do the miracle. It's not about them, okay? And that is made very clear in Joshua chapter 3. It's all about God. And instructions are given to the people on how to follow the ark. Verse 4, you've never traveled this way before. I love that phrase. So the priests carrying the presence of God, they have to go ahead. And there's a lesson for us all, though, I think. God must go before us. Sometimes we try and get ahead of God, don't we? And God must go before us. God must go before us. And there's some instructions given. Stay about 0.5 mile. Some versions will say 2,000 cubits behind the ark. I want to ask you guys a question. Why do you think the instruction was to stay 0.5 mile behind the Ark of the Covenant as they were about to walk into the Jordan River, why do you think the children of Israel had to stay half a mile behind? Has anybody got any thought? Gabe has put social distancing. Wow, we can really make this applicable. Brilliant. Okay, social distancing, godly distancing. Why was there some godly distance going on? Anyone got any thoughts here? You can chat in the group chat or you can wave at me. I will. Oh, Gabe, go for it, Gabe. Oh, Kat.
No, I just said because the presence of God would have been too strong and mighty for other people to be so close to it, other than the priests.
Absolutely. I mean, that's certainly one reason here. The Ark of the Covenant represented the presence of God. And there's plenty of stories in the Bible. Mm. Was it Uzzah, in the reign of King David, who put his hand on the ark and was immediately struck down and killed? And so the ark of the Lord is so powerful, it's holy, and there is this kind of, we've got to keep our distance from this, okay? So there is an answer there. Has anybody else got any other thoughts on this? Why the distance between the ark? Let me tell you this. I think, as well as the holiness and the power of God, to stay far enough behind the ark was so the people could see where they were going. Okay, there's a practical thing going on here. Okay, so they could see the river, so they could see what was ahead, but also so they could witness a miracle. It was important. It was very important that the people of God, the people of Israel, could see the miracle unfold. So we've got the holiness of God. There was distancing because of that. And it was so that the people could see where they were going. And so as well that people could see miracle take place. I want to see miracles take place. And I want to stand back enough just to observe and watch God do his work. I don't want to get in the way of God's work when it's all kicking off and just allow God to do his thing, to see miracles take place. Okay. And so I believe that's why there was a bit of a distance going on there as well. The second thing I learned from this chapter, and I'm keeping my eye on the time, is preparation as well. Verse 5 says this, purify yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do great wonders among you. Who wants to see God do great wonders? Yeah, I do, and he is, and I believe that. Who wants to see miracles happen? You see, there's an important message here. Preparation is key. God wanted his people to prepare themselves if he was to reveal himself in a special way. In terms of Jewish tradition, that could include washing clothes, abstaining from marital relations, confessing sins, all that kind of stuff. But in short, when the Lord comes, his people must be prepared. And there's a lot of fuss, you might say, a lot of fuss about distance and preparation. But it was crucial. It was crucial that Israel recognized that everything that is about to happen, the miracle of the Jordan River, is all God's work. Okay? It was important that they could see God at work. But the thing is, as well, the other thing I learned is, unless we have proper insight, expectancy, and preparation, we won't understand the value and the significance of God's work. Okay? Let me explain this a tiny bit further. I'm using a historical analogy here. It's all I know. I do apologize. Has anybody bypassed on the motorway up in the Midlands the Battle of Bosworth Field? The Bosworth Field, I think it's up in Leicestershire somewhere, okay? And being the geek that I am, I was driving up to see some family once upon a time and I saw Bosworth Battlefield. So I thought, oh, I'll turn in there and I'll go in there. What you need to understand, if you ever go and visit Bosworth Battlefield, where Richard III was killed by Henry VII, okay, what you need to understand is it's just a field. If you went to the field, all you would see is a field and go, history is really boring, John. You've taken us to a field, okay? But what you need to do, first of all, is you need to go to the visitor center. You need to go to the museum. You need to take the tour. You need to understand what the battle was about. You need to understand the context. You need to understand the characters. You need to understand the fighting. And once you understand all that, you then go onto the field, and that makes complete sense. It's not just a field anymore. And so preparation is key. This is true of Joshua chapter 3 and 4. God's people must be rightly prepared, one writer said, for God's show. If they're going to appreciate it, if they're going to be strengthened in their faith. And although God may not now cut a path through the rivers for his people every month or so, the principle remains. God is a God who makes a way for people in impossible, impassable circumstances, but God's people need to prepare themselves. I believe God's going to do some great things for us as a church. I really, really do. We've talked about this already. Miracles are happening as we speak. I believe the lost are going to get saved. The sick will get healed. I believe it all. But we, as the body of Christ, have got to be prepared. We've got to be prepared for all this to unfold. And so this is kind of training right now, I suppose, and it's kind of a warning. Hey, let's get ourselves ready. Let's get ourselves ready for what's about to come, for what's about to happen. You know, do we prepare for the practice of public worship for God? You know, I find Sundays at the moment quite interesting, because I'm normally used to being at church at 8 o'clock, practicing with the band, all that kind of stuff. Now I'm rolling down at 10 o'clock with a mug of tea and in my slouchies. And I find myself that actually I have to get prepared more than I've ever done before, because I want to get in the right frame of mind to worship God in my living room and all that kind of stuff. And it's brought on a whole new degree of preparation. Okay. Let's live our lives prepared. Let's live our lives expectant that God can move and will move in every aspect of our lives if we put our faith and our trust and our hope in him. Number three, let's talk about greatness, the making of greatness, God's man and God's woman. I love this. Joshua 3, verse 7 to 9. God tells Joshua, "Today I will begin to make you a great leader in the eyes of all Israel." Later, the writer states that God was as good as his word. Joshua was made great. He was exalted in the eyes of all Israel, and they revered him as they did Moses. I tell you what, this was Joshua's moment. Given the crisis of Moses' death, the transition of leadership, and the struggle for conquest that lay ahead, it was crucial that Joshua felt secure in his position and that Israel be confident of his competence under God. Throughout the sessions that we've studied so far, we've compared Joshua to Moses. Now, Joshua is about to be elevated to greatness on an equal footing, if not more so than Moses. So this is Joshua's day. Today, God says, I will make you great. But I love that phrase. When we feel low, God speaks to us and he says, I want to make you great. Great men, great women, for the kingdom of God today, not tomorrow, not yesterday, not in the future, but today we can be that great man of God, that great woman of God that he has called us to be. I really, really, truly believe that. John Maxwell, and then I'll open it up for comments and questions. John Maxwell says this. He does a great comparison of Moses and Joshua. I'll read you this. Moses led through 40 years of desert travel. Joshua led through 30 years of conquering Canaan. Moses was a political, diplomatic leader, and Joshua was a military, in-your-face leader. Moses patiently listened to complaints. Joshua confronted laziness and fear of the enemy. Moses led people as a peacemaking shepherd. Joshua led people as a tough commander. Moses provided water from a rock when the people got thirsty. Joshua told the people to dig their own wells when they got thirsty. I love some of those comparisons that John Maxwell kind of highlights. Let's just go down some of the chats. And if anyone wants to say anything so far about this, that would be great. Ian, preparation. Preparation is so important. Preparation is our responsibility before God can do his work. Caroline, failure to prepare is preparing to fail. Gabe, a key is just a key until you have a door to unlock. So just some comments there on preparation. If we want God to see God do his work. I've got two more points. Oh, sorry, Mike, were you going to say something?
I was just reading about the preparation, and it says, obviously, as Joshua, about sanctifying yourself. I was thinking on that and doing some reading in the background. And obviously, God wanted the people to be sanctified because God was going to do something holy and magnificent by parting the Jordan. So he didn't want them to come in with a frame of mind of irreverence.
That's right.
Something mighty was going to happen. And so he wanted them, or priests who asked them to be sanctified themselves, he wanted a sense of anticipation as they went forward into the Jordan. And as you said, they stood back so they could witness the holiness of God producing a miracle.
Absolutely. That's a wonderful comment. Thank you, Mike. That's great. And actually, that leads me on to my next point, God's power. Verse 10 to 11, Joshua 3, verse 10 to 11. Let me just read this. Today you will know that the living God is among you. He will surely drive out the Canaanites, Hittites, Hivites, Perizzites, Girgashites, Amorites, and Jebusites ahead of you. Look, the Ark of the Covenant, which belongs to the Lord of the whole earth, will lead you across the Jordan River. I think sometimes we've lost our sense of the bigness and the greatness of God. You know, we reduce God to a three-letter word. You know, we use it in everyday language, we don't, but it is everyday language for many, many people, that phrase, you know, and we've lost the sense of the bigness and the greatness and the awesomeness of God. He's not just the honorary leader of our club, but he is the living God who works and intervenes and comes and saves and rescues and counsels his people. He is the Lord of all the earth. Let's stop making him small. We have a tendency to make God small. And let's get a revelation, a fresh revelation of God, shall we? He is a great God. He's a great God here and now. He's brought us in. He's brought us through. He will take us through. He provides a way. He is a great God. Where man says it can't be done, God says, I can do it. He is a great big God. And we tend to make him small, you know? God is not a small. He's great. He's Lord of the whole earth. Okay.
Amen.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you, Mike. That's great. Finally, this is the real juicy bit before I hand over to Caroline. God's method. God's ways aren't our ways. Okay? Let's talk about the Jordan River. And actually, Gary, before we talk about the Jordan River, can we show that video, that little documentary thing for 2-3 minutes? Is he still there? Is Gary gone? Gary?
No, I'm still here. I've just had a few issues here in my end. Which one of the two videos? The one with the dates on or just the other one?
The one that you suggested.
Oh, the one with the dates. Yeah, no worries. I can get that up for you. One second.
Have a look at this, everybody. This is all about God's method. And it just might highlight a few interesting points for us. If you're into your geography, has anyone been to the River Jordan at all?
Anne.
Oh, Anne, can we unmute you, Anne?
She's unmuted. Unmute yourself.
Anne, can you unmute yourself and just talk to us about the River Jordan? All right, Anne?
She is unmuted. Anne, are you speaking? Because we can't hear you.
No, she's not speaking.
We can't hear you, Anne. That's okay. I'd like to go. I'd like to go. Ian, have you been to the River Jordan?
Been to the River Jordan. In places, it's not as spectacular as you think it is. But a fascinating place, it really is, to actually go and see it for your own self.
Yeah, definitely. Gary, how are we doing with the video?
Yeah, ready when you are.
Oh, let's go for it. Let's go for it.
Okay.
There are a bunch of stories in the Bible that most folks have a hard time believing, like the story of the Jordan River politely stopping so Joshua and the Jews could cross into the Promised Land. Who's going to believe that? It defies the laws of physics. Water flows downhill. The Jordan River drains into the lowest spot on Earth, the Dead Sea, the drainage pit of the Middle East. It's a quarter of a mile below sea level. Here's the shocker. The Jordan River has stopped before, many times. Most recently in 1956, but most remarkably in 1927, that's when it stopped at the very spot the Bible says it stopped for Joshua, at a city called Adam. The Bible says the Jewish refugees were following behind some priests who were leading the way carrying Israel's most sacred relic. It was the Ark of the Covenant. That was a gold-covered chest that held the Ten Commandments. Here's what the Bible says happened next. As soon as the feet of the priests who were carrying the ark touched the water at the river's edge, the water above that point began backing up a great distance away at a town called Adam. Let's put that on a map. The Jews were camped at Acacia Grove in what is now the Arab country of Jordan. If they walked west toward a popular crossing point in the river, a shallow ford, which is a bit like a sandbar, that would have put them about 20 miles south of the ruins of Adam. Adam was on Jordan's side of the river, not Israel's side. The Arabic name for the ruin is a similar sounding name. It's Edomia. And here's where the Bible story starts to make sense. The Jordan River runs along a fault line. Two plates of the Earth's crust are moving in the same direction, but at different speeds. When their edges grind into each other, earthquake. In 1927, an earthquake shook loose the 150-foot-high cliffs near the ruins of Adam. They crashed into the river and dammed it up for 21 hours. This is a photo of cliffs hovering above the river several years before the quake. Some wonder if that's what happened in Joshua's day. That there was an earthquake. If so, some would speculate, the quake and its aftershocks may have brought down the walls of Jericho as well. Lots of Christians have trouble with this theory because they say it diminishes God, it robs him of his supernatural power. Others disagree, and they say God made the laws of physics and he doggone well knows how to use them.
Yeah, interesting. I watched that the other day and I thought, very good. You see, let's talk about the River Jordan. It overflows its banks throughout harvest, yet Joshua has said that everybody will walk through it just fine. And we begin to read Joshua 3, verse 14 with a lot of expectancy. They're building up to cross the river. The priests are ready. They're about to dip their feet in. And then the writer decides to dampen the tension by telling us about the river conditions. The writer tells us about the river conditions. We want them to cross. It's going to be a great miracle. And the writer says, let me tell you about the river conditions going on here. Can I ask you a question? Why do we need to know about the river conditions in this story? Has anybody got any thoughts? Why are we being told about the river conditions? Oh, Peter, let's go to Peter, please. Gary, thank you.
He's unmuted.
I would say that the fact is that God is amplified there because it was, if you like, in flood, so it wasn't sort of in flood. So that was the possible.
Yeah.
Is it flood stage?
Yeah, absolutely. God is amplified there. That's what I picked up there. Anybody else got any thoughts? Shirley, let's go to Shirley, please.
I've seen the Jordan River, and when I saw it, it looked pretty much like the River Exe. However, when we turned around, there was a sign saying how high the river was when it was overflowing its banks. And where we were standing, we were next to the river, and if it had been overflowing its banks, we would actually have been drowned, because there is such a big difference in the height. And so this is why, I think this is why it says the Jordan overflows all its banks during the whole time of harvest, because so that people can't make God look smaller. It was overflowing. It was a raging river. It was very, very big, and it was a raging river. And it also tells us it was the time of harvest. So there's no insignificant detail in the Bible. It's significant. It's a time of harvest. And I think the whole of this is very significant for this time that we're in now. This is a time of harvest.
Great. No, that's great, Shirley. Thank you for that. I think that was a great answer. The answer that I put down to that question myself was this. We're told about the detail of the River Jordan because of this. The river helps us to appreciate the miracle. The river helps us to appreciate the miracle. The detail is important because God led the people through the river when it was at its worst. It was impassable and it was impossible. God wanted to show his might and power in the face of our utter helplessness. We don't contribute to anything to do with our deliverance. It's God's. God brings us into impossible circumstances so that we can come through trusting in his grace and in his power. Our help comes from the Lord. He is the God of miracles. I also love with this story, the feet, the priest's feet had to touch the water. They had to get a bit wet first. Is this going to work? Is it not going to work? The priest actually had to touch the water with their feet. And then God, as soon as they stepped in, God made a way. And I think there's a few things there, surely, that we can learn for ourselves as well. Gabe's put here, complete reliance on God. And Gary has said, shall I show the river flow? I've got another little video. Do you want to see the flow of the River Jordan in peak season? All right. You know, just give you a little example. When that river swelled, they've got to get 1 million people across. That's different. Okay, maybe 3 or 4 can get across, but they've got to get 1 million people across. It's kind of interesting as well. John Ward, you made a comment about the earthquake, you know, and some people have debated all this about the dry riverbed. I'm not a geologist. I believe this, that God could use natural events to make a way, but I also believe in this in a God of the impossible, and things are just inexplicable as well. I firmly do. I don't know if anyone's got any other thoughts. John, did you want to expand on that at all? John Ward, give us your thoughts on that video, maybe. Oh, he's muted.
Can't hear him.
Unmute, John.
I can't unmute him from this end. He won't let me.
No. Sorry, John. I'm sure what John was about to say was really, really good. So we'll carry on there. But I believe in a God who can use natural means and, of course, supernatural means for the miracles to happen as well. So that is the parting of the River Jordan. It almost replicates Moses and the children of Israel. There's all these kind of parallels going on here. Karen has said, it reminds me of when the furnace was 10 times hotter. The sacrifice of Elijah was soaked with water. Mary was a virgin. God uses the utterly impossible, uncomprehendable means and methods to get our attention, so that we can put our faith and trust in him. He's the God of miracles, everybody, and he still is the God of miracles. Okay? He still is the God of miracles. What I want to do right now is this. We're going to jump on to chapter 4 here, and I'm going to pass on to Caroline. So there's going to be a bit of a Caroline. you take the lead, communicate with Gary, and we'll aim to finish in about maybe about 20 minutes for Q&A, and then we'll say goodbye. So Caroline, over to you. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm picking up from the start of chapter 4. So I'm just going to read the first little bit there. I don't know if it's going to come up on the screen or not, but I'm reading from the NIV, not the NLT. So it says, when the whole nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, choose 12 men from among the people, one from each tribe, and tell them to take 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, right from where the priests are standing, and carry them over with you and put them down at the place where you stay tonight. So Joshua called together the 12 men he had appointed from the Israelites, one from each tribe, and he said to them, go over before the ark of the Lord your God into the middle of the Jordan. Each of you is to take up a stone on his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the Israelites, to serve as a sign among you. We'll come back to that in a minute. Okay, so the first thing I kind of want to point out is when the whole nation finished crossing. So that's the really important thing, that actually it wasn't just part of the nation, that the whole nation crossed the Jordan. God didn't leave anyone behind. And I think that says to us how important it is to finish. And I think that a lot of what this bit is actually kind of links into what Ian was speaking about on Sunday as well, that these they're actually finished what they started. So God actually finished the crossing. And then as I read it, Joshua then picks 12 men, one from each of the leaders of the tribe of Israel. And as I read it, they've all crossed. And then each one person from each tribe goes back to where the Ark of the Covenant is in the middle of the river and picks up a stone. Now, we're not talking like a pebble. You know, it's probably not like what David had in his list about a pebble, because it says that they had to put it on their shoulder. So this would have been like a big boulder. And then they would have had to carry that back to the other side of the river and then put it down where they camped for the night. We'll come back to why they did it in a little while. So I want you to imagine what that must have been like. So they're picking up these boulders and they're carrying them. So just kind of give us an indication of how far they might have had to carry them. They actually camped the night on the one side of the Jordan. When they got over the Jordan, they camped for the night. But then the Bible says that they went to Gilgal. So they went to Gilgal. And I think, Gary, there's a map. If we can see a map, Gary, of the distance between the River Jordan and Gilgal.
Yeah, let me just find that for you. Just 1 second.
Talk amongst yourselves.
If you carry on, I'll throw it up in a second. I'm just trying to discover. There's lots of options on here.
Okay. So when Gary finds the map, we'll see that actually it is a fair distance between the Jordan and Gilgal. So it's actually, according to my research, about 46 miles. And that would have taken them walking from there to Gilgal would have taken about 13 hours. So can you imagine that they'd have to walk 13 hours carrying these boulders on their shoulder? And I don't know about you, but you probably think, what is the point? What am I doing this for? Okay, that's a different map to the one that I...
Wild guess. I'll try another one.
Don't worry if you can't do it. So anyway, I want us to get that kind of impression of how hard that must have been, how painful that must have been to have carried these boulders to Gilgal. Okay. So now I want to go back to the reason why they were asked to pick up a boulder. And yeah, so this is it? From
the children not to forget.
Yes.
So this is from Joshua 4, where it says, in the future, when your children ask you, what do these stones mean? Tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the Ark of the Covenant when it crossed the Jordan. And these stones are to be a memorial to the people forever. So that was the reason why they had to pick up the stones right from the middle of the river Jordan and bring them to a place called Gilgal. And then Joshua built an altar. And the reason was so that the people and the following generations could know what God had did and that he was powerful. So that was the reason. And if we link it back to us, Ian spoke really well on Sunday about legacy. And actually, when we go through our Jordan experience, and when we're in the middle of something, it's the hardest bit, isn't it, when we're in the middle of something, because we can't see that we can get through it. But actually, what God wants us to do is through the most difficult times in our lives, through the most difficult Jordan moments, he wants to take us something significant, like a boulder, out of the middle of that river, and then carry it, actually, not for our own benefit, but actually carry it because he wants it to be a symbol of people to come, future generations, of what God has done. And to carry something like that is hard work, it's painful, but it is to help other people in the future. So, and just want to give an example from personally, my own personal experience. So for example, many of you will know that I have had difficulties with my mental health over the years. And praise God, I've been really well over the last few years. But when I was going through a really tough time, it was like a River Jordan, because it was a really hard time in my life. But I had to learn to take something from the very centre of that difficulty, how I coped with that and God's faithfulness and how he got me through it, and actually carry that then to help other people in the future. So my testimony of how God brought me through that, I can now use as a legacy for those people coming behind to say that actually this is possible to get through it with God's strength and help. And I guess a really challenging question is, what is our Jordan? What is our Jordan experience? And what have we actually carried, or what can we carry from the middle of our experience? And then it be used to help a future generation know about the goodness of God. Okay, so I don't know if that's a question I'm just going to throw out, so you can either write on the chat, or if someone has got a comment that might want to make. Anybody?
Derek.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Good. I've always thought that those boulders that have come out, they've come out of a terrible journey, and it was going to be a weakness for a further generation.
Yeah.
So your children will say, what is the meaning of these stones?
Yeah.
In our experience of Christian church, Christianity and family, we have the table of the Lord, the bread and the wine. So we're able to tell this generation, this speaks of the tremendous deliverance that we have had, the bread and the wine. They'll say, what's the meaning of the bread? What's the meaning of the wine? We will be able to tell them our redemption.
Yes. Yes. Isn't that the story of a lot of children? I grew up like that in church, and my boys, they... I know Harry has had conversations sitting next to Sarah in communion and giving her a little nudge and kind of going, Mummy, what's the meaning of this? You know, tell me about it. And what a learning experience it is as she passes on exactly what Derek has just said to the next generation. This is our freedom right here, Harry. This is why we do what we do, because of Jesus. And Caroline, carry on. Sorry.
Okay, so yeah, I think I'd really encourage us to think, and maybe it's putting people on the spot right now, but think about maybe for homework, I guess. Sorry, John, if you're setting homework, but about what your River Jordan experience might be or has been in the past, and actually what have you carried or what can you carry from that experience to bless and help future generations see the goodness and faithfulness of God. So that's something to think about. But the other thing I just wanted to point out was it says that the stones that were set up, and it actually says that they're there to this day. That's what it says in Joshua. Now, you know, you can either think, is that literal or is it not literal? But I actually do believe that the Bible is literal, and I actually think that that is possible, that those stones be there to this day. They might not necessarily be as they were set up, as in they might have been built up, and over time they might have been knocked down, and they might be in a different format. But I looked this up, and I looked at Gilgal, and I looked at these stones, and I'm not saying this is exactly true, because it might not be, but you can take it with a pinch of salt. But I do want to show you an image that has been taken from Gilgal of stones in a particular shape. So I don't know if we can see that, Gary. No? Hello?
Yeah, I'm just picking it up for you now, Kaz. One sec.
Okay, thank you.
Carry on talking. I'll throw it on the screen so I get access to it.
Okay, so when the image comes up, I want you to see what you think the shape of those stones are. And I'm saying, you know, obviously take this as a pinch of salt, but I just thought this was quite interesting. So, and it reminded me of the verse.
Yeah, sorry, Kaz, it's not coming up at the moment, but open it.
Okay, so the picture actually shows some stones from the air, but it actually shows it to look like it's been formed into the shape of a footprint. And that really, I really like that, because it reminded me straight away of the verse in Joshua, when God had said to Joshua before he went, before he started leading the children of Israel, he says in Joshua 1, verse 3, I will give you every place where you set your foot, as I promised Moses. There we go. So, people see that? So, it looks a bit like a foot shape. And I'm just reminded that actually God's promise that he can give us. He gave Joshua the promise that wherever your foot treads, I will give you the land. So just something out there to think about that I just thought was quite interesting. But I think the main thing that to bring out of this kind of thing about taking the boulders out of the river is about leaving a legacy. It is about what can we pass on to the future generation.
Thank you so much, Caroline. That's really interesting, isn't it? And I love that. And there's a few comments here. I put a few comments in the group chat. Take something from the middle of the miracle and carry it with you into your future. All right. So when you're going through that miracle, take a memento of what God has done for you. The wonder, I've also put, the wonder of the moment will be lost without a monument. The wonder of the moment will be lost without a monument. When God is doing something wonderful and something is happening, set it up as a testimony so you'll not forget it. And you can tell, as Caroline said, the future generations about what God has done. Gabe, have you got a few things you wanted to say there?
You have to unmute yourself, Gabe. So.
Right, so I was actually like in the middle of typing, but I'll say it. Based on like what you put, John, about taking something from the middle of the miracle. Sometimes during a miracle there can be a toil, something that we have to also work for.
Gabe.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Are you there? Say something, Gabe.
Can you hear me now?
You can. Start again. Sorry, buddy.
Right, sorry. So I was saying that sometimes during a miracle, there can be a bit of a toil as well, something you have to work for, and that, you know, we have to pick up something to take forward into the new, that it's not just going to be an easy ride, that there's going to be something significant that you have to carry forward. And I think the whole journey from Joshua 3 into Joshua 4 is almost like the journey of us as Christians, that we need to sanctify ourselves, we need to purify ourselves and follow what God has done, and he'll take us through the waters and out into where he's called us to be. That there is such a, I mean, you think about it, when someone gets saved, that they pray for forgiveness of their sins and they purify themselves, and there's usually the step where they go into baptism and they go through the waters and come out into their new life and living into the promise that God has given them. And there's normally a verse that gets given, a memento that's given at that time as a stamp of, this is the new time for you to live, this is the new life that you now have. And I think that it's so important that we keep looking at this to know that God has brought us out. He's brought us out, and we keep looking at the verse that we've been given or the promise that God has given us to know that he was faithful in the beginning and he's faithful till the end. Yeah, that was it.
Wonderful, Gabe. Thank you. I think you've just summarized that session well. Mike, you want to say a few words? You have to unmute. Here we are.
Yeah, I've got a question for you, John. If I've read this correctly, and Caroline, that they laid the 12 stones or boulders at Gilgal.
Yeah, Gilgal.
But there's also the 12 stones that Joshua set up in the river. Is that correct?
Yes.
So the question is, why did he set up an additional 12 stones in the Jordan? That's one for you to answer next week.
Thank you. Yeah. No, I'll do the research. We kind of skipped over that. What some people would say that actually it's about the storytelling that's going on here as well, and that there is some different, you know, if you've got two writers, they're writing different things, or one writer, it could be a point of view or just something in the story, or they simply might have been two monuments set up as well. So I will look into that for next week for you a bit more. All right, there we go. You set me some homework now. Lovely, lovely. Derek, let's go to Derek.
Would it not be that the stones that were left there that was in the water was of the past, and my past is buried? My
Wonderful.
Past is finished with, and I've come out with new stones. You
yes.
are.
Yeah,
that's wonderful. We'll go with that one. That's what a wonderful image of baptism. Baptism for you. Yes, absolutely. Brilliant. Ian says, don't give up halfway through, celebrate along the way. Again, this is application, loads of wonderful stuff that we can apply here. So hey, it's 10 to 9, everybody. We're gonna wrap up, and I hope you've just they might leave some of these sessions might leave more questions than answers. And if you go away and study and get revelation and bring it back to the group, that is absolutely wonderful as well. And I would encourage that wholeheartedly. Absolutely. Next week is a special one. We are looking at Joshua chapter 5, and we've got to reestablish, before we can take Jericho, we've got to reestablish some things in our lives. And so you might want to read ahead in Joshua chapter 5. And it's very, very interesting for a number of different reasons. But I've got a few questions, homework questions, and I'll make sure that everybody has access to the sheet. It'll be on our website. I'll email it to life group leaders as well. But Gary, have we got the worksheet there? So there's a worksheet coming your way, and once again, number one, what is the significance of the 12 stones plucked from the Jordan River? why do you think God made the crossing of the Jordan so grand? Number three, do you prepare yourself to meet God in worship? Number four, how has God recently displayed his power in your life? Number five, where do you notice the wonder of God the most? And number six, when do you see his hand at work?